All right. Thanks for coming out. I'm happy to be able to resume our Wednesday share. We had a little hiatus, but hopefully everyone's well recharged, and even with Pesach and everything. But we're back in action, and have to thank Usher for the idea. I was actually very excited about it. The idea of we, especially in our discussions in shul or just in general in learning, there's something that I was thinking about that, and I don't know if it's the case in like other areas of study, meaning in the Torah, the different svarim, different sources kind of take on a life of their own. Talk about it to get started with mentioning the Magen Avraham, Avraham Dumbiner, and I didn't know his name until recently, a little back, but I lived in the 1600s in Poland. But just one example, you quote different names that are quoted frequently, names of different Shach, Taz, Rush, Riff, all of these some are modeled or stands for an acronym for their names. But in Torah, sometimes it becomes one kind of conglomerate of different sources and different ideas. And I think in some way it speaks to the strength of Torah, is that the Torah that our Gedolim left was more than just a book that they published. It was something that just became so much part of Torah that it even took on a life of its own. But sometimes, whether it's the later source could be the last 1,000 years or in the Talmud and the Mishnah, or even Tanakh for that matter. Sometimes we forget the context, who the people were, and how you get to point A to point B. That how did the halakha develop? And there are a lot of questions that come out of it. What sources are authoritative? I think we see in some contexts, can a later generation argue with an early generation? Is there an absolute authority now? Can different Gedolim argue with each other? I think the answer is yes. Can an earlier generation argue with the later generation? It depends. In the introduction to Igros Moshe Feinstein says that he's presenting the topics as he's seen them, and he sees that they don't contradict. And I think it's a key point. They don't contradict anywhere in Talmud Bavli. But yeah, he may disagree with the come to a different conclusion with the Chasam Sofer lived 100 years before. But he says that he's not going to disagree with Talmud Bavli. So there is some, obviously there are some limits into what is authoritative, what maybe holds less weight, and it kind of sometimes becomes one picture, which is beautiful, one beautiful painting, but I think it could be interesting and worthwhile to see, learn about the process and learn about who the players were. I mentioned in my email, but I also didn't know until fairly recently. Both the Ramar Moshe Isserles in the 1500s in Poland, and the Shach or Shabsia Kohen, both main commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. They both died. One was 41, one was 42. The Shach was like on the run from the pogroms in Ukraine. Being just to give an example, these were like real people who did extraordinary things. Yeah, Shriver Gaon, who lived in like year 900, lived like 100 years. But the people were living with different challenges and different situations. And hopefully, in the next couple of weeks, we could just take a look at some of the history, but also how the halacha plays out with throughout different time periods and with different figures. But I think to start off, and I was also with preparing this, there's no end. We could focus on figures in Tanakh for 2 years. We could focus on more than that. We could focus on the Mishnaic period, Talmudic period. But I was thinking maybe we could focus more after the Talmud Bavli, after the Babylonian Talmud. But I think before we get there, we need to see what the process was, what was behind the Babylonian Talmud coming into existence. Because of all the figures and ideas that we'll be introduced to, after the redaction of the Gemara, what we call the Gemara, the Talmud Bavli in the 5th century, basically no one after would argue, would have a different interpretation from one that was found in the Talmud Bavli. There may be discussion about if it's unclear what position we rule like, but there was never, afterwards, you didn't have someone come along as great as they were and have a new interpretation, an interpretation that was contrary to something found in the Babylonian Talmud. At the same time, the sages of the Talmud could argue with each other, but the sages of the Talmud generally have a rule they don't argue with a Mishnah. How did that come into existence? What happened before? Where do you draw the line? So I just want to take a look first at how the Babylonian Talmud came into existence and what the process was like before and how it achieved the status that it did. Because again, that's really the starting point for any authorities that came afterwards, is the absolute authority of the Talmud Bavli. So before we get to the Talmud, we have to back up to Har Sinai, to the revelation of the giving of the Torah. Make this whole series very fitting to do before Shavuos. Because Kabbalah says, when we receive the Torah, it was not just what the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, the Chumash, what we have in the Torah scroll, but it was also the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh. And the Rambam, as again came in the 12th century, and we'll see in subsequent weeks what the Rambam was doing, what he says in the introduction, was sort of a next phase, at least as he envisioned it, as he expressed it, with the real codification of law. But the Rambam, actually his commentary to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, lays out what's been abridged in the 13 principles of faith, the Ani Mamins, or said more poetically in Yigdal. I was tangentially, Yigdal is sometimes recited responsively. I always thought that was a little weird, like you're saying you believe in half of the Ikari Muna. I mean, I don't think it's so, but that's really what Yigdal is. It goes through all of the principles of faith. So the eighth principle of faith is that it's Torah Min HaShamayim, that the Torah that we have now is the same Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Rambam continues, and that's also true for, he says, a Torah HaMekubal Gam Kein B'Pi HaGvura, the received Torah, meaning the Torah Shebaal Peh, was also given at Har Sinai. And that's where we learn basic information about the mitzvahs that we practice. How do we know what a sukkah is supposed to look like? How do we know how many species are in a lulav? What a shofar, tzitzis, tefillin, totafos. The Torah doesn't say anything about that. How do we know how to slaughter animals? So it doesn't say that in the oral Torah, but it doesn't say that in the written Torah, but Moshe Rabbeinu was also given an oral Torah, which he then transmitted to the people, to Yoshua, and then to the Zakenim, also a plug for Pirkei Avos coming up Shabbos afternoon. And there are allusions to this in even the Psukim themselves. In number two, it's when it says that Ayel Chukim HaShmitanim HaMishpatim Batoros Asher Nasan Hashem Beino Vein Bnei Yisrael Bahar Sinai Biyad Moshe. These are the statutes, the ordinances, and the Torot, the plural Torahs. What does it mean, Torot? So Rashi says, quoting from the Medrash, one is Torah Shebeksav and one is Torah Shebaal Peh, the written Torah and the oral Torah. And what was included in the oral Torah? If it's not written down, it's harder to know what exactly was included. So, number three, the Pesukim Dvarim and the Talmud Yerushalmi says that, learns from the language of some of the verses, that it included the what was given to Moshe Rabbeinu included the Mikra, the written Torah, Mishnah, Talmud, and Haggadah. The Mishnah, Talmud really is in this context, and the way the Rambam uses it is more the analysis as opposed to Talmud Bavli, Amar Rav Ashi. That I don't think it meant to say that, but it means Talmud, the methods of interpreting law, and then the Gada Medrash, more of the narrative ethical teachings. But also he says, and this is, was made, I think, more popular by the Ritva in Erevin, when it says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, these and these are the words of the living God. It goes farther, and then it says that even afilo masha talmud vasik asi lahoros lifnei rabo kfar nemar lemoshe misinai. Even something, an idea, an insight that an experienced student offered was even said to Moshe at Har Sinai. So what does it mean that everything, that even that, every single thing that anyone would say was given at Sinai? So there's some discussion about what exactly it means. But there's another medrash in Shmos Rabbah that says, and I think it's a little more on a basic level, that what does it mean that Hashem gave Moshe the entire Torah Shebapeh, the oral Torah? It meant that he gave him the, because how could Moshe learn the entire Torah, everything that could ever come out of Torah in 40 days? Okay, well, I guess if you're on Har Sinai with Hashem, anything's possible. But the Medrash says that. So he says, what was given to Moshe? Klolam, Ladu Kadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe. He taught Moshe the principles of how to interpret law. We say Rabbi Shmuel Omer Shlosh Esrimi Atorah Nidreshes Bahem. There are different methods that we use to interpret and derive laws. For example, Gezeira Shava is two words that are used in different places. Now that needs a tradition. I can't just say, I don't know, I see Adam here, Adam there, so I'm going to make something up. But so there's that. There's tradition. There's Kal v'chomer, which is more of a logical derivation. If something applies in one place, it applies in another. There are different tools that are given. Obviously, with the experience and tradition, knowing how to use those tools, we can accurately interpret the Torah. So it seems at least that was what Moshe Rabbeinu was given. And you could say that any, whatever, that the tools were the tools that Moshe was given would be the tools that any student of Torah and anyone came after him would use. And we talk about the oral Torah, but I don't know, we have some volumes over there. The oral Torah takes some more books than the written Torah. So what happens to the Torah being oral? So the first question is, what's the seems there was some kind of preference for it being oral. That was a preference for being oral, but the Gemara Gittin number 6 says that it was really not desirable to write down the oral Torah because Hashem gave it orally, not to be written down. So it's probably meant to be that way. Because it says, "Ksav lechas advarim ma'ela," write these words, but it says, "Al ki al pi advarim ma'ela." So when it says, according to these words, so it makes a distinction. Some things you write, some things you don't. And it says, Ela, Ela, Takosev, Ia, Takosev, Halachos. So Ela, meaning you write down the words of, well, what, the written Torah? And what they call Halachos, meaning the oral law, you're not supposed to write down. Why, what's the desirability of the Torah being, or a portion of the Torah, a major portion of the Torah, being oral as opposed to written down? That seems much better. You take notes. Yeah. That's a good. So there's, right, there could be a couple reasons. One that the Ran says in number 7 that when you write things down, when you're sitting there taking notes, I'm not very good at taking notes, but when you're just like sitting there taking notes and writing away, you're not necessarily so engaged. You could also not be taking notes and not be engaged too. But sometimes when you're writing something down or you're reading something from a text, there may be a limit to how much you're endeavoring to understand it. And if that's the case, that the Ran says that the way the portions of the oral tradition were given were that they required understanding, they required a detailed explanation, And that had to be learned and developed from a teacher. And so there's a process of learning with the teacher, discussing it, and really trying to understand it in a deep way, understand the logic, the rationale, the details themselves, and just to write it down. So the idea was, the original plan was that, okay, the Torah is a lot, the Torah, we call the Torah, the Chumash, is a lot more concise. It has just it's interesting. There's certain things the Torah goes into detail that we may not expect, but for a lot of things, the Torah is very concise. So you have the written Torah, it's concise. And then when you really want to and need to learn and delve into it and make rulings, so you need that needs to be done by engaging with one's teachers, with one's peers, and also the additional effort that it takes to memorize something, to really master it to that degree, well, as a way of ensuring that the integrity of the Torah will be protected. There's also, I didn't put it on here, but I saw from the Rav Soloveitchik that he said that the oral Torah allowed us to maintain the accuracy and integrity of the Torah Shebe Ksav. You see, other people have gotten their holds on the written Torah and they misinterpreted it, but the oral Torah was meant for us, was not meant, because if missionaries and others, they could Google things and find things from the Talmud, but you can imagine if nations of the world had access to the oral Torah, they could have distorted it in the same way that they did the written Torah, and that would have impacted, you know, our religion and our practice in very, very significant ways, maybe even more so than the written Torah. But the basic idea was it was supposed to be something that was supposed to be living, active, and not supposed to be written down. Okay, so what was the process? You know, eventually it was written down. So what was the process and why was it written down? So we've mentioned the Talmud Bavli, the Mishnah, certain endpoints where it seems like discussion, you know, kind of stopped. But what about until then? So what was the system? So Pirkei Avos, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. Sorry, Yeshua. Moshe received the Torah from Misinai, gave it to Yeshua, to the Zakenim, to the elders in the times of the early Nevi'im, and to Till the Nevi'im. And the Nevi'im, the prophets, gave it to the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah. I put some dates here. So the Torah was given, if working with the secular calendar, in 1313 BCE. So Moshe received the Torah from Sinai in the 14th century BCE, then from the time to the prophets until the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly. So it was about 1,000 years. And among the members of the Great Assembly who were responsible for certain enactments, including the standard tefillos that we daven, or the latter prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, Mordechai, that's a tradition that he was on the Anshei Knesset HaGadol. So it was in the early second temple period around then. And that was the train of tradition. On the last page I copied from Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman, he traced from his teachers to Moshe at Sinai. You can see he was able to connect with the years every single stage. So but that was basically the train of transmission. So then what happened? So when it says Moshe received the Torah, gave it to Yeshua, Yeshua to the Zakenim, etc., prophets, men of the great assembly. So how did law work? How did it work? Did they have Gemara with different opinions? Did they have different old Sfarim on the shelves? What was the system? So the Rambam, in his introduction to Mishnah Torah, gives a history. It says that originally the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law, was taught orally, and each generation they would take notes on it, but it was never a compiled text. So each individual would write down the parts and keep notes. But any question, any law that needed to be determined was deduced by applying the 13 principles for interpreting the Torah. So that was done more locally. And then if there was a big question, a question that was too difficult for the local courts to rule on, so you bring it to the the Beis Din HaGadol, the great court in Yerushalayim, the court of 71. And that was basically how things were determined. You didn't really look in a sefer. Things that were, there was a central authority, and there seemed like also that there was a bit of independence, meaning in each community, when they were able to, obviously they had to be qualified, but when the local scholars were able to determine a law with the 13 principles, so they would do that. It would seem to be a local decision-making process. They'd look at this issue and they'd say, how can we apply this? And come to a ruling. If the ruling was too difficult, then they would bring that to the court of 71. And that court would give a ruling. But all of these, all of this knowledge, all of the corpus of the Oral Torah was unworldly. And when it came to rulings, it was either done locally or was brought to a central court. And the Rambam says that's how it was done until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi lived in the second century of the Common Era. And he was the redactor of the Mishnah. But until the times of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who's called Rebbe or Rabbeinu HaKadosh, so basically it was done orally, it was done locally. Then Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did something that was radical, really. He wrote down the Oral Torah. Again, the Oral Torah, by definition, is supposed to be oral, but he wrote it down. So what happened? So
he wrote down the five books. That's what he wrote down.
It became the sixth book, the six sections of the Mishnah.
Okay, so I'm just confused that Moshe gave over the five books.
Right, but I think it's really the Torah Sheva Peh that it's saying that they transmitted to the different generations. The Oral Torah, meaning obviously the five books were kept in existence. But really, that chain of tradition, this Imperik Avos thing, is really describing the transmission of the Oral Torah.
Okay, so writing things down took place by
Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the second century of the Common Era. So, roughly 1,500 years after the giving of the Torah. So what happened?
The Torah was...
Yeah, I was just...
The Torah was written.
Yeah, the five books were written first.
Yes. And the oral tradition was given to Moshe, who transmitted that, meaning the explanations of certain laws, the methods for how to determine laws were given to Moshe, and he passed that methodology and that information to Yeshua, and then Yeshua to the elders, and it was always done orally. And different scholars would determine local questions, and if there were bigger questions, they'd bring it to the Sanhedrin HaGadol, the court of 71. But then Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did something radical, so he gathered together, he gathered together all the traditions, enactments, explanations, the Firushim and interpretations that he heard from Moshe Rabbeinu, or had been collected and transmitted by courts in every generation, until he wrote them down in the book Sefer HaMishnah, in the six sections of the Mishnah. And how did that gain acceptance? So he wrote it down in the Mishnah, and it taught it publicly, and they taught it so that the oral law wouldn't be forgotten. And why did he do that? And he said because he saw that the suits were becoming fewer and fewer, calamities were continually happening. The Roman government was persecuting the Jews. This was in the aftermath of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So he wanted to compile a work that would serve as a guide to all people so that the Torah would be forgotten. And throughout his life, he continued to construct in the Mishnah. Now the Mishnah is not, in the Mishnah, there are debates, meaning what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did is he wrote down take the sages of the Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva, whatever. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would write down what they said. He would record the debates. And you see, even at that time, there were debates. Sometimes he may have a preference for a certain opinion, but he wrote down the debates, the discussions that were going on, and he wrote it down in a way that's pretty terse and concise. The Mishnah is generally not so long. And he wrote it down, even though it was not ideal to write down. But Ace Lasso, there's a time to act. There are some, you know, don't try it at home, but there's a principle that during certain times, in order to maintain the Torah, you can violate something. Again, that has to be done with caution. But that was the idea behind writing down the oral law. Yes, it was supposed to be the oral. It wasn't supposed to be written down. But otherwise, the choice was either that or the Torah being forgotten. So Yehuda Nasi wrote down the teachings of the sages in his time and with what they received from going back to Moshe at Sinai, and so that the Torah wouldn't be forgotten.
You have opposition?
So look at number 10 in the Smag, Moshe ben Yaakov, lived in 13th century France, to put when everyone lived. How did the Mishnah become so accepted to the point where, you know, basically there's a principle that the sages of the Talmud, the Amorayim, who came after the time of the Mishnah, basically will not argue on a Mishnah. Maybe they'll have another Mishnah to bolster a point, but they won't necessarily have an idea that contradicts anywhere in Mishnah. I mean, the Mishnah at a certain point is viewed as authoritative, and even the period of the Tanayim, the Tanayim, the sages of the Mishnah, and the Amorayim, the sages of the Gemara, were viewed as kind of a break. That in general, in Amora, a sage of the Talmud doesn't argue with the Tanis. The first generation Rav, there were certain exceptions that were continued in the early times of the Amorayim, but basically there were, the Mishnah became authoritative. So how did it become authoritative? So the Smag says that it was really because of, one, the stature of Rebbe. It was Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, that he was one, the greatest Torah scholar, but was also a very prominent person. He was very wealthy. He had a prominent even in the he had good relations with Antoninus, who was the Roman governor. They spoke about different philosophical things. In fact, Antoninus would come and hide out, and they didn't want everyone to know that he was learning with the rabbi, but he's this Roman person to have philosophical discussions. And so he was prominent in that sense. He had an in with the government. And he also was respected among the Jewish people. And what he did, and we'll see a similar language when it comes to the acceptance of the Talmud, he says, V'kibetz kol chachmei ha'aratzos yosef shisha sidri mishnah al pi ha'gabala. He gathered all of the sages in all of the different provinces and founded the six orders of the Mishnah according to tradition. So it seems like what happened was Rebbe Yehuda Nasi felt a need to write down major sections of the oral law, and he gathered all of the sages and they all gave their consent. So it was the force of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi's personality, his scholarship, his prominence, and the fact that he was able to, and through that, was able to gather all of the major Torah scholars in all of the different communities, and they all accepted it. And because they all accepted it, it became binding. So you think, happily ever after, but you think, okay, now our problem's solved. We don't have to write down anymore. But then the Smag continues in number 11, after the times of the Mishnah, so there became more persecution and the Jews were dispersed to more places. This was in, so the Mishnah was in around the year 180. Then the next couple hundred years in the towards the end of the Roman Empire, things were not good for the Jews. So then you had the Amorayim, the sages of the Talmud, who went and then needed to clarify the rulings of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah was purposely written in a, you know, kind of terse, brief language. Okay, so it's like, you know, you don't have the oral tradition, it's not orally, but you have, you know, bullet points. But you don't really have the analysis. But then the Jewish people became dispersed, there became increasing persecution, and then people weren't sure. People, even the Amoraim, weren't always sure what exactly the Mishnah meant. So then eventually, next couple hundred years, you had, there was Rav Ashi, who was also actually very, very wealthy, very prominent. He was the learned the yeshiva. He was in Babylonia, in modern day Iraq. He's in the academies of Pumbedisa. He was in Sura. He had his own yeshiva, Master Machasya. He was also the most prominent person, and he made it his project to record the different discussions that the Amoraim, the post Mishnaic sages, had. So this was, this was in the year around 450. So in the close to 300 years, there was a lot of discussion about rulings of the Mishnah, the oral law in general. And so he made it his project to compile this all in the Talmud. And that became what we call Talmud Bavli. We got the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, but this is the Babylonian Talmud. Babylonian, basically the sages of the Mishnah were based in Eretz Yisrael. Rebbe was in Sipori. They all lived in Eretz Yisrael. The Amoraim were, even ones recorded in Yerushalmi, but the Amoraim were certainly the sages of the Bavli were in Babylonia. So it was in the academies of Babylonian. The prominent ones were Sura and Pumbedisa, and there were others, and that's where the discussions took place. So there's clearly a geographic change. At times of the Mishnah, most of the Jews seem to be in the land of Israel. Then afterwards, as the even though destruction was in the year 70, as persecution became more intense, so the Jews left Eretz Yisrael and went to the neighboring countries, and that's really where the center of Torah learning developed in Babylonia. So, and after a couple hundred years, Rav Ashi made it his project to edit the Talmud, to record all the different discussions among the sages, and put it in, basically to put it in a book. The Mar Mordechai says that he's working so hard on it, and he wants to, after he puts it together, he wanted to review it. The Gemara says, the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, wanted, said, okay, your time's up. He was already old. He said, give me 30 days. I want to, go over it again, make sure it's all, and everything looks good. And basically, Rav Ashi was the, Ravina and Rav Ashi were the compilers of the Babylonian Talmud. We call Talmud Bavli. There were some portions of the Talmud that were written it a little bit later, meaning it wasn't totally okay, put it to print, and this is exactly, there were no other, there were some edits made in the period of the Sevarayim, a little bit afterwards. There's even some portions of the Gemara that they're more identified with, 100, 200 years later. You even have some sages who were after Rav Ashi, but basically the Talmud was finalized with Rav Ashi, who was in Babylonia. Okay, so why was the Talmud Bavli finalized in the way it was? So in number 11, the Smag says, same thing, that Rav Ashi, similar to Rav Yehuda Nasi, he was until from Rebbe to Rav Ashi, lo matzino Torah gudula b'makom echad, he didn't find Torah and wealth and distinction in one person. And v'nasa nekadosh baruch hu chein b'enei melech pras, he gave Rav Ashi a favor in the eyes of the Persian king. He had friendly relationships with the Persian king, just as Yehuda Nasi had friendly relationships with Antoninus, the Roman governor. And what did he do? Same way that he describes the redaction of the Mishnah. V'kivitz kol chachmei Yisrael, he gathered all of the sages of Israel, shekol haratzos, in all the lands where they were. V'nidu peres haMishnah. He gave a commentary of the Mishnah, and he called this one Nikra Talmud Bavli. And then he called this the Babylonian Talmud. So I drew Bahaskamas Kol Chachmei Ador. And it was arranged with the consent of all of the sages in that generation. So you have two very important things when it comes to the Mishnah and the Talmud Bavli, is that the person who, or the people involved with the project were very influential, but it was, but mainly it was accepted seemingly unanimously because of the stature of who they were, because of the how they evaluated it, but it met unanimous acceptance. And because of that, the Rambam says in number 12, his introduction to Mishnah Torah, because of that, they were really the last to enact gzeros, decrees, enactments, or to introduce binding customs on the entire Jewish people. The Rambam also says this in Hilchos Mamrim elsewhere, that there's a unique status to the Talmud Bavli that that really no other work after it has. Now, it'll be a recording. You'll say the rabbi says you don't have to follow the Shulchan Aruch, whatever. I'm not saying that. But there was something that's unique that was very definitive about the Talmud Bavli. And it was really because it met unanimous acceptance. And it was really the last time that decrees that were enacted among the sages of the Talmud were binding, are automatically binding on everyone. And the Rambam says that after that, any Kol Beis Din, the next page, Kol Beis Din Sha'amad Achar Gemara, that any court what did the system look like afterwards? We'll see, then the Rambam was coming to say, to make his work be connected, to serve kind of a similar function as the Talmud Bavli. But he says, but what happened afterwards? The Kol Beis Din Sha'amad Achar Gemara, the Kol Medina Medina, any court that arose after the times of, at the ceiling of the of Talmud Bavli in any country and made decrees or enactments or had a certain tradition, so they can impose it on their location, on their city. But Lo Pashu Masa B'Kol Yisrael, but they couldn't be spread and ratified and universally accepted by the rest of the Jewish people, because they're rachodli, she will say them, they were shivos hadrachim, because they became even more spread out. There was seemingly lack of communication. Travel was dangerous. So the Rambam says that nowadays a Beis Din doesn't have, nowadays in the 1100s, that, but basically after the Talmud Bavli in the 5th century, basically any court was local, that any rabbi, any rabbinical body could make enactments and has the authority to make enactments for those under their jurisdiction. But because now it was impossible, and sometimes the Rambam, to achieve unanimous acceptance in the way that the Mishnah and then the Talmud Bavli was, then basically everything now is local, at least on an absolute binding level. So when we come to we set the foundation with the Talmud Bavli, so basically anything we look at after the Talmud Bavli all recognize and assume the authority of the Talmud Bavli. And that's basically how we got there. First, there was the Torah Shebal Peh. It was transmitted orally. Then it became difficult, and any questions were decided by either local authorities or brought to one central court, and one central court that was accepted by everyone. But there wasn't. Rav Shri Ragon, and he has a long letter on this, and he also says that there wasn't really the same type of differences of opinion. It was more straightforward until then. Local bodies would make decisions. They bring that to the, if there was a more difficult case, they bring it to the central court, and that was basically it. But then there became confusion, and then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi compiled into the Mishnah, which received unanimous acceptance. And because it was accepted unanimously, it became binding, which suggests, and I think with logic of the Rambam, if there was something afterwards that really earned unanimous acceptance, so then ostensibly would be binding on everyone. If there was one body that everyone or every other rabbinical authority accepted, So then ostensibly would be binding. You would potentially have the same type of thing, because you haven't had, even the Rambam wasn't unanimous, you haven't had the same type of acceptance, but you had that with the Mishnah. Then there was confusion about the exact details recorded in the Mishnah. And then you had the Babylonian Talmud. And that was accepted unanimously. And then afterwards, each local court could rule for their jurisdiction. And so then after that, when there became more communications, even in local questions, that's really when the debate starts. But it's the debate all based on the rulings in the Talmud. Maybe debate as to what the correct ruling is, but they're no longer new. There were these two cutoff points, which we don't really see in the same way afterwards. The Mishnah was a cutoff point because it was unanimously accepted. The Talmud Bavli was a cutoff point because it was unanimously accepted. Then you have other, and this will be something that I'm excited to explore. What about other things? We showed him Achronim. There's early authorities, later authorities. There's not the same. There's not the same division as there is with the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Talmud. In fact, there's some early Achronim argued on Rishonim. There's not so, but it also gets into a question: what becomes binding? What can a later generation argue on? But this is how the Talmud Bavli came into existence. What about the Talmud Yerushalmi? So, the Talmud Yerushalmi was really developed in the Galilee earlier, shortly after the redaction of the Mishnah, about 300-350 CE. But it didn't have the time to be really edited in the way that the Bavli was. And it was wide. And it's sort of the Yerushalmi really kind of has stayed that way because it wasn't as popularly learned. So that's why last year in Toronto, we learned, we learn Masechta Shviyos, and Yerushalmi is very. There are always these different manuscripts. It's not put together in the same way that the Bavli is. They can be very difficult to read because you have statements that kind of end, and then there are different versions. It's not edited in the same way that the Bavli is. It can be very challenging. Because one of the great achievements of Rav Chaim Kanievsky is that he's his commentary on Yerushalmi. Art Scroll did an amazing thing with the Talmud Yerushalmi, but it's not edited in the same way. It can be difficult to learn, and was really sidelined, but it was really surpassed by the Talmud Bavli. That being said, there are areas of halakha, particularly in the Seder of Zerayim, with laws pertaining to agricultural laws in Eretz Yisrael that are only found in Yerushalmi. And of Shvi, as well as of Truma and Meiser and Shemitah, all of that is only Yerushalmi. So those were maintained because that's the only way you could learn about those halakhas. Happens to be for most of our history, most of the Jewish people, those halakhas weren't relevant, which is also why the Yerushalmi is both the editing of the Yerushalmi originally and the fact that in the Bavli, there were people kind of constantly keeping track on it. With Yerushalmi, here and there, but not in the same way. So that's sort of why the Bavli gained prominence over the Yerushalmi. And that's why, in general, if the Rif, who was one of the, we'll meet him, but he was in the early codifiers of Halacha, he basically takes the statements of the Gemara that he determined were Halacha and just in the back of the Gemaras and just puts those to give you the bottom line. He explains why but he says very clearly that the Bavli is authoritative over the Yerushalmi if there's ever a disagreement between them. Because again, the Yerushalmi, it seemed like the way it was edited wasn't the same, didn't have time to be edited with the same precision as the Bavli. Also, the Bavli came later, and it was considered that the rulings of the Bavli, when they contradict the rulings of the Yerushalmi, that the Bavli the Bavli is authoritative. Again, grant that there are certain areas that the Bavli doesn't cover at all, which obviously then you have the Yerushalmi. But that's how we got from Har Sinai to the Talmud, and that really sets a very definitive point in our history, from which everyone who came afterwards looks to. this is all the foundation that they're working with, the language they're speaking. And I will, in coming weeks, we'll see then what you do with the Bavli. It's the same. And you'll see it's the same cycle. The oral law is too confusing. We don't have a record of writing down the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah is becoming too confusing. We're not sure what it says. We're going to write down the Gemara. Then the Bavli is too confusing. We're not sure what it says. So then we're going to go and figure out what that says. Then you have the Rambam, and the Rambam is too confusing. We're going to figure out what that. So you do kind of see the cycle. But what comes after this, 1,500 years after the Bavli until the present, is determining what the Bavli means, but also responding to real conditions in the real world. And hopefully in coming weeks, we'll take a look at the development of who the key players were and go a little bit more into what the background was, what their lives were like, what kind of issues they were contending with, and excited to journey with you.
Thank you.